Welcome to episode 506 of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. In today's podcast, we're going to be addressing a topic I love to call weird but high yield spinal cord disorders. Weird but high yield spinal cord disorders. These disorders that I'm going to talk about, you don't find them in many resources, but they do show up on the USMLEs, step one, step two, step three. So I want to discuss them so you can basically have a collection, have it well organized in one podcast. So again, I would strongly encourage you, pay attention to this stuff. Don't sleep on it. All right. So the first thing we're going to discuss before we jump into the spinal cord is the following, right? So what are the key pathways in the spinal cord? There's a ton, but what are the ones that are really exam worthy? Obviously, in the posterior part of the spinal cord, we have the dorsal columns. In the dorsal columns, and don't worry, we're going to give a bunch of vignettes here. In the dorsal columns, that's what controls vibration, proprioception, fine touch. Fine touch, vibration, proprioception. That's like the posterior third of the spinal cord. And then if you look around the posterior / lateral sides of the spinal cord, that's where we have the corticospinal tract. Remember, at that point, the corticospinal tract has literally already crossed. The corticospinal tract, as we know, crosses in the caudal medulla. And it's called corticospinal because it starts in the cortex and ends in the spinal cord. So the corticospinal tract has already crossed. So whenever you have any dorsal column problem, any corticospinal tract problems in the spinal cord, what you're going to notice is you're going to see ipsilateral symptoms. So if you damage the corticospinal tract on the left side, you'll have left-sided symptoms. Corticospinal tract on the right side, you'll have right-sided symptoms. Since we already talked about the dorsal columns, if you also damage the dorsal columns in the spinal cord, you'll have ipsilateral problems. You'll have ipsilateral loss of vibration, fine touch, and proprioception. Now, the other major pathway in the spinal cord is clearly the spinothalamic tract. Remember, the spinothalamic tract, you think of them as being very anterior and lateral in the spinal cord. Very anterior and lateral in the spinal cord, right? So that they're like on the tips, the lateral front tips. Sometimes it's just good to use a simple descriptor to get certain points across. The lateral front tips of the spinal cord, that's where we're going to find the spinothalamic tract. Those things carry pain, pinprick, and temperature. Pain, pinprick, and temperature. Think of PowerPoint, PPT. Pain, pinprick, and temperature. Pain, pinprick, and temperature. And if you damage the spinothalamic tract in the spinal cord, you're going to notice what? You're going to see a contralateral loss of pain, pinprick, and temperature. It's going to be contralateral. Why? Because that's like one of those key pathways that crosses in the spinal cord. It crosses in the anterior white commissure. That's why if a person has a syringomyelia, a problem with the central canal of the spinal cord, they can have that bilateral loss of pain, pinprick, and temperature, right? That pinprick and temperature loss in a cape-like distribution, right? So if you damage the spinothalamic tract, notice everything so far I've been saying ipsilateral. For dorsal columns, I said ipsilateral. For corticospinal, I said ipsilateral. That's in the spinal cord. Remember, these problems, you may see contralateral issues if you are hurt elsewhere. I'm just referring to the spinal cord, right? But spinothalamic, you're going to see a contralateral loss of pain, pinprick, and temperature. And then another high-yield pathway, right? It's not really a pathway, but these are your lower motor neurons, right? These are going to be in the anterior part of your spinal cord. You're going to be more anterior and in the middle, okay, on both sides. Those lower motor neurons, right, they go straight to the neuromuscular junction where they release acetylcholine so that you can act on the nicotinic acetylcholine receptors that we find on our skeletal muscles. So what's the deal with these? Well, these, they just go straight to the neuromuscular junction on the same side. So guess what? When you damage the lower motor neurons, sometimes we call them the ventral horn, that is going to cause a person to have ipsilateral weakness. And remember, there's a few things that can mess up these lower motor neurons. I've talked about them in other podcasts, so I'm just going to give a quick drive-by, right? But don't forget polio. Polio can cause lower motor neuron issues. Don't forget West Nile virus. West Nile virus can cause lower motor neuron issues. Don't forget the spinal cord disorder, Wernicke-Hoffmann disease, that's spinal muscular atrophy, right? Autosomal recessive problem, chromosome 5 in the SMN1 gene, causes a lower motor neuron issue as well. And then don't forget amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, ALS. ALS is an upper and lower motor neuron disorder. So it damages both your corticospinal tract and it also damages your anterior horn, your ventral horn. Okay, your anterior horn, your ventral horn, your lower motor neurons. So again, please, if you see any of these terms, it's the lower motor neurons that are being referred to. They can be called lower motor neurons, they can be called anterior horn, they can be called ventral horn. All right. So let's begin to maybe throw in a few. The thing is, these spinal cord disorders, many times the key way to recognize them is just by the clue. Recognize them by the clue, right? So because really, if you think about it, when you have issues with the spinal cord, sometimes the problem can be within the cord itself, right? Sometimes we use the term intramedullary for that. But sometimes, or actually quite a number of times on the USMLEs, when a person has a spinal cord problem, it's because of extrinsic compression, right? Extrinsic compression. And again, remember, if you damage the corticospinal tract, right? Since we said it already, I said you're going to see ipsilateral symptoms. But what are the ipsilateral symptoms you're going to see? Well, you're going to see ipsilateral symptoms like hyperreflexia. You're going to see spasticity. You're going to see spastic paralysis. And you're going to see a positive Babinski sign, right? A positive Babinski sign that is ipsilateral. Remember, that positive Babinski sign, sometimes on your exams, instead of calling it Babinski, because they know that's in every Anki deck known to mankind, they'll call it an extensor plantar response. Basically, you have a fanning out of your toes. That is not normal. So if you damage the corticospinal tract, you're going to see hyperreflexia, spasticity, right? A lot of spastic paralysis. You're going to see an extensor plantar response. Now, and honestly, like, you're going to find many of those symptoms specifically in a person that has a cornos medullaris syndrome, you're going to see a lot of upper motor neuron symptoms. That's like a very nice clue that, man, this is probably cornos medullaris syndrome, because many people tend to mess up cornos medullaris syndrome with cauda equina syndrome. Cauda equina syndrome tends to present more with lower motor neuron symptoms, right? That's one way, honestly, I've pretty much always divided these things up, and it's been pretty helpful on exams. So cornos medullaris, you're going to see a lot of upper motor neuron symptoms. Like, predominantly in the question, you're going to see a lot of upper motor neuron symptoms. But in cauda equina syndrome, you're going to see a lot of lower motor neuron symptoms, right? Like, you know, hyporeflexia or irreflexia, you know, muscle weakness, things like that, okay? Because cauda equina syndrome, it's less of a upper motor neuron issue, is more of a lower motor neuron and nerve root issue. That's the way I kind of think about it. So cauda equina is a lower motor neuron and nerve root issue. So you're going to see some radiculopathy symptoms as well. But cornos medullaris is more of like a straight up upper motor neuron issue. Okay, so let's go ahead and talk through this, right? So what if they give you a question about a 32-year-old female and they tell you that, you know, she has this, she has had bilateral lower extremity weakness for a few days, and they tell you that 3 years ago, she had very painful, she had to come to the emergency room because she had a very painful eye. Well, clearly that's multiple sclerosis, right? That is clearly multiple sclerosis. Remember, those people are going to have neurological deficits that are separated in space and time, right? There are many findings in MS, right? They can have like optic neuritis, painful vision loss, right? That's clearly an ophthalmologic emergency. Obviously, in that case, you're going to shoot for those steroids, right? You're going to give IV steroids. If not, the person is going to go permanently blind, right? And this person, again, also has, lower extremity weakness and all these things. And you see their symptoms just come and go, come and go, come and go, come and go. If you see that, think of MS. And MS is characteristically on the MBMEs, tested in a female in her 30s. Don't get me wrong. Can people that are not in their 30s get MS? Absolutely. But usually, overwhelming majority of the time, an MS patient on your exam is going to be in their, it's going to be in their 30s. But again, MS, how do you differentiate it from some other disorders? Because there are some other disorders that look like MS, but are not MS, and our friends at the MBMEs expect you to know those disorders. And I guess one thing I'm going to say is that MS typically affects the brain and the spine. So that's why usually when people have MS, you're going to do an MRI of the brain and the spine. But what if they give you a question about a person that, you know, they have these periodic paralysis, right? You notice that, man, they have these, you know, paralysis of the lower extremities that seems to come and go, right? And the thing is, many times when they have these episodes last pretty long. They last for a long period of time, but it's episodic, so it comes and goes. And you may even notice that they have this painful vision loss, so they have optic neuritis, just like you see in MS. But then they tell you in the question that, oh, that they get brain imaging and they see nothing. They see nothing. And you're like, that's weird. I don't see those same white matter lesions as I see for MS. And then they can tell you that, oh, that they did some blood studies and they find autoantibodies against NMO. Autoantibodies against N as in Nancy, M as in Mabel, and O as in Oxford, right? So they see anti-NMO antibodies. These are IgG antibodies. If you see this, I would really hope you're thinking about Devic's disease. Devic's disease. D-E-V-I-C. That's one name it can be called. Or, you know, many of you know this as neuromyelitis optica. Neuromyelitis optica. Neuromyelitis optica. So you're going to see a person having a lot of spinal cord problems, right? A lot of like motor weakness and stuff like that. You're going to see like spinal cord weakness that is periodic, right? So it's basically episodic, right? But each episode lasts pretty long. And they may even have optic neuritis. But again, you get brain imaging, you don't see the MS lesions. That's not MS. That's neuromyelitis optica. And remember, one of the nice ways to know that, oh, for sure, I'm dealing with neuromyelitis optica, is you're going to find IgG antibodies. It's an autoimmune disease. You find IgG antibodies against NMO, okay? And IgG antibodies against NMO, all right? And again, remember, another thing you may see for neuromyelitis optica on your exam is Devic's disease. You may see it called Devic's disease. Okay, now what if they give you a question about a person, you know, this person has like some kind of viral infection, right? They have like a viral upper respiratory infection or a viral GI infection. And then you notice that over a few days, they begin to get like very weak. They start having all these sensory problems in the extremities and stuff like that. They have bowel bladder dysfunction, right? If you see this, honestly, and then they tell you that, oh, that you check out the brain and you notice that, man, they don't have any characteristic MS lesions on a brain MRI. If you see this, I want you to think of transverse myelitis. I want you to think of transverse myelitis. Now, I know some of you may be like, come on, Divine, like seriously, like, okay, this sounds a lot like MS. Like, how are we going to differentiate it? And this sounds a lot like neuromyelitis optica. How are we going to differentiate it? Okay, calm down. Let me explain. First things first, transverse myelitis, their symptoms are usually associated with a recent viral infection. That's one. Two, people that have transverse myelitis, their symptoms are not episodic. They have their symptoms develop and it'll just last. It's usually like a one-time thing that they have, right? Although it could be recurring. But most times, right, you have a viral infection and then you notice afterwards, you see a lot of weakness, a lot of bowel bladder dysfunction, right? And also, one fairly helpful feature with transverse myelitis is they're going to have a lot of sensory problems. Sensory problems, you may not see those. You may not. I didn't say you absolutely will not. You may not see those in neuromyelitis optica, right? And one other thing that also helps with transverse myelitis is that, again, if you check the brain for the characteristic MS lesions, you're not going to see those characteristic MS lesions, right? Another thing that also helps with differentiating transverse myelitis from MS is that typically in MS, if you check their CSF, you're going to see oligoclonal bands. Or, you know, sometimes they may tell you that you see an elevated IgG index, But in people that have transverse myelitis, you're not going to see oligoclonal bands on CSF studies. You're not going to see an elevated IgG index. So that's very, very helpful for differentiating MS from transverse myelitis. And again, remember, neuromyelitis optica, their symptoms are episodic. Transverse myelitis, usually on the USMLEs, their symptoms are not episodic. Also, in transverse myelitis, again, you're not going to see these anti-NMO antibodies. You're going to see those anti-NMO antibodies in a neuromyelitis optica. And typically, people that have transverse myelitis, they do not have optic neuritis, okay? They're going to have that painful, sudden onset vision loss. Neuromyelitis optica, right, tends to have that optic neuritis, okay? In fact, look at the name, neuromyelitis optica, is affected, right? But again, transverse myelitis, you don't see anything about the eyes in that. So hopefully with these, again, that's why I said this is a podcast on weird but high yield spinal cord disorders. Again, sorry, you got to know these things for your exams, right? Again, we're trying to score as high as possible on this podcast. So you just got to go the extra mile. So hopefully now you can clearly see the differences between MS, neuromyelitis optica, which we also call Devic's disease, and idiopathic transverse myelitis. Okay, now what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that, oh, this patient, they just had a cardiac surgery, right? Cardiac surgery just finished, right? Or you see a person that has like a lot of AV malformations, like a person that has an Osler-Weber-Rondeau syndrome. And then they tell you that, man, after cardiac surgery, this person is having, a lot of, this person just has this sudden, right, that they were not like this before surgery, but they have this sudden flaccid paralysis. They have a lot of weakness. They tell you that they've lost pain, pinprick, and, temperature sensation. If you see something like this, I really, really want you to think about a person that has literally infarcted their spinal cord. They've literally infarcted their spinal cords. Okay? They have literally infarcted their spinal cords. They've literally done what? Infarcted their spinal cords. Right? So what are going to be the risk factors on your exams? You can see a person that has had a recent MI or AFib. Right? Those people can form emboli in their hearts. Those can flake off, go to one of the vessels that supplies the spinal cord, and they can get a spinal cord infarction. You can also see this in a person that is very hypotensive from cardiovascular surgery, right? So like, for example, a person that has just had a cardiac bypass and you see that they have these symptoms, think of a spinal cord infarction, right? That hypotension can cause an ischemic infarction of the spinal cord, right? And also, if a person has had like surgery in the aorta, so like surgery for a AAA, like an abdominal aortic aneurysm or a thoracic aortic aneurysm, those things can cause those people to also, if they are very hypotensive during the surgery, because those are very high-risk surgeries, those things can certainly cause a person to have infarction of the spinal cord, right? And also people that have AV malformations. Remember, an AV malformation is when you have a direct connection from an artery to a vein, right? So you're pretty much skipping the capillaries. But remember, the capillaries are kind of important. That's where you have gas exchange. So these people basically don't have good gas exchange that can cause issues. Now, again, you may ask yourself, Divine, how do I know that this is a spinal cord infarction? Well, look at the pattern. Look at the pattern. Look at all the symptoms that I mentioned. The one symptom I did not mention was what? I did not say anything about the dorsal columns. Typically, when people have spinal cord infarction on the USMLE exams, you're going to see corticospinal tract problems. You're going to see spinal thalamic tract problems. You're going to see ventral horn problems, but you will not see posterior column problems. You will not see dorsal column problems. So by the way, another name for the dorsal columns are your posterior columns. Just keep that in mind. Why? Because they are posterior in the spinal cord, right? So you're going to see that pattern. Many times when people have spinal cord infarctions, it's going to affect the anterior two thirds of the spinal cord, Okay. And again, this aortic surgery, especially AAA fixing and development of spinal cord infarction, you kind of want to know the relationship, right? Because the thing is, there's this artery called the artery of Adamkiewicz, Adamkiewicz, the artery of Adamkiewicz. So that artery of Adamkiewicz, it's a branch off of the aorta. Okay, especially the abdominal aorta. So if you're having like a AAA surgery or you have a ruptured AAA, the artery of Adamkiewicz can be infarcted, and that's going to infarct many levels of the anterior two thirds of your spinal cord, right? So you're going to see like an anterior spinal artery syndrome. So again, please, in summary, infarction of the spinal cord problems, many times they're going to show up as anterior spinal artery syndrome. Just going to keep that at the back of your mind. Again, that artery of Adamkiewicz I mentioned gives rise to the anterior spinal artery for quite a number of levels of the spinal cord. So you can get spinal cord infarction from that. All right. And then remember, what if they give you a question about a person and this person, they tell you that they have a lot of, loss of vibration, proprioception, fine touch loss, right? They tell you that they have like a sensory ataxia, right? And they also tell you that, man, this person has a, hyperreflexia, spastic paralysis, and all these things, right? So if you notice, what am I focusing on here? I'm focusing a lot here on three groups of symptoms. Number one, I'm focusing on dorsal column problems, loss of vibration, fine touch proprioception, right? So dorsal columns gone. Number two, I'm focusing on a lot of upper motor neuron problems, right? Like spastic paralysis, hyperreflexia, extensor plantar response, which we also call the positive Babinski sign. And then also I'm talking about a sensory ataxia, right? Because the spinal cerebellar tracts are also messed up. You put all those things together and they may tell you that, oh, this person's hemoglobin is like 7, right? So it's pretty low and their MCV is like 120. 12, right? So this person clearly has a microcytic anemia. This clearly makes sense as what? What are you telling me? I hope you're telling me, oh, Divine, this sounds a lot like B12 deficiency, okay? So this person has a vitamin B12 deficiency. This person has a vitamin B12 deficiency, okay? This person has a vitamin B12 deficiency. But please be careful. Our friends at the USMLEs, sometimes they will not make the question a slam dunk. Instead of giving you the, because what made this question super easy is when all of a sudden talked about the microcytic anemia. They won't always give you the microcytic anemia. Please keep that in mind. Sometimes they can give you like a surrogate, right? So they can give you all these symptoms. And then you notice that, wow, this person's homocysteine levels are elevated and their methylmalonic acid levels are also elevated. When you see that combination, that's a B12 deficiency. Remember, there are two causes of elevated methylmalonic acid on your exams. Number one, it's going to be B12 deficiency. Remember, folate does not elevate your methylmalonic acid. But then if you also have a methylmalonic acidemia, right, because you have a problem in the enzyme that metabolizes methylmalonic acid, that's more of a biochemical disorder, that's step one territory, that can also cause a person to have a elevated methylmalonic acid, right? So one thing that can also help here is the pattern, because remember, B12 deficiency causes what? A subacute combined degeneration of the spinal cord. Right, you're gonna mess up the, so it's a combined degeneration. So you're going to mess up two pathways in general. You're going to mess up the posterior columns, the dorsal columns. You're going to mess up the corticospinal tract. But one thing that you can also kind of throw in there, you can fold into that is damage to the spinal cerebellar tracts. That's why these people may have a sensory ataxia, right? And don't forget, when you have a B12 deficiency, right? You can also have the microcytic anemia. That's why I gave that clue in the first place. But again, they may even, I kid you not, the USMLEs may even give you a B12 deficiency question and the person will not have anemia. Just be careful. Like literally, be careful, right? So the fact that you don't see that anemia does not mean the person doesn't have B12 deficiency. B12 deficiency does not always cause anemia, okay? Well, but we're not going to go into the reasoning behind that. It's not very necessary for this podcast. Now, what if they give you a question that looks a ton like B12 deficiency? It looks a lot like B12 deficiency, but then you notice that the person's methylmalonic acid levels are completely fine. The homocysteine levels are completely fine. And they tell you that, this person is being treated for Wilson's disease. Sorry, scratch what I said on being treated for Wilson's disease. But you see a person, let me take a step back. So you see a person, they seem to have like classic B12 deficiency symptoms, right? So they have many of the upper motor neuron problems, corticospinal tract, dorsal column problems. And then they tell you that this person, you know, takes a supplement and they tell you that the homocysteine levels are fine, the methylmalonic acid levels are fine. And they tell you that the person takes a supplement to make them not have the common cold. If you see this, I honestly want you to think of copper deficiency. You're like, what? Copper deficiency? Yeah, I want you to think of copper deficiency. So let me give you some clues that will tell you that, oh, this is copper deficiency. You're going to see a question that looks an awful lot like B12 deficiency. Okay, and we've talked about B12 deficiency. But then you're going to notice some things that don't line up. Number one, the person will not have microcytic anemia. Right, you may see that. They may not have a microcytic anemia. Their homocysteine levels will be fine. Their methylmalonic acid levels will be fine. And then they'll give you a high yield history. Although again, sometimes some of these clues I've given, they don't give it. But they love to give this high yield history with some of these questions. What's the high yield history? Basically, you may see a person that's taking in a ton of zinc. Right? Because many of these common cold supplements have zinc in them. Zinc loves to bind up copper. That can cause a copper deficiency. Another classic one, they love this one on the exams, is a person that has had bariatric surgery. So a person that has had a Roux-en-Y gastric bypass, right? That's a big one they love to test. Because many times when you have a Roux-en-Y gastric bypass, one of the big places you bypass in the GI tract is the duodenum. So many of the things that are reabsorbed in the duodenum, you start developing deficiencies of those things if you've had a gastric bypass, if you've had bariatric surgery. So you see a person that's had bariatric surgery and they have like many of these B12 symptoms. I want you to think of copper deficiency because copper is reabsorbed in the duodenum. That's pretty high yield actually to know for exams. Copper is in fact reabsorbed in the duodenum. Okay, so again, this is pretty high yield to make sure that you understand for your exams. And again, remember, I've kind of talked about this in previous podcasts, but whenever a person has a spinal cord problem, right, like a general pattern, right? So this is like a general pattern for spinal cord injury. You're going to see upper motor neuron problems at the lower level in the body. And then you're going to see lower motor neuron problems at the same level, at a higher level in the body. So it's almost like there's a reverse. I've explained this in detail in other podcasts, but you're going to see upper motor neuron symptoms at a lower level in the body, and then you're going to see lower motor neuron symptoms at a higher level in the body. That's a very classic way to know that, oh, wait, this person likely has some kind of spinal cord problems. Okay, some kind of spinal cord problems. All right, especially when you have spinal cord compression. These things I just mentioned, this pattern I just mentioned, something that's very characteristic of spinal cord compression, right? So again, you're going to see many of these symptoms. Many times you're also going to see things like bowel and bladder dysfunction, right? You're going to see many of these problems, right? So again, if your spinal cord is being compressed, right, you may see like neck pain, especially if you have like a cervical myelopathy. You may see like back pain, right? And again, you're going to see many of these symptoms we've talked about, right? Many of these symptoms, bowel bladder dysfunction, right? All these upper motor neuron problems, depending on where it is, lower motor neuron problems, depending on where it is. We've talked about all these things. Now, before we talk about causes of spinal cord compression and wrap up this podcast, again, I just want to put in a plug. If you're studying for any of your USMLE exams, I have a course that can help you, right? So I have a step one class coming up in March, like literally the 1st to the 7th of March. All these classes over Zoom. I have a step two, step three course in February. And I also have a series of other courses in February for step one to step three. The NBME test taking strategies course, that's 2.5 hours long. That's on the 15th of February. The biostats class is a 4-hour class. It's on the 16th of February. And the social sciences and ethics class, it's a 5-hour class. That's on the 17th of February. Again, many people have taken these courses and found them to be extremely helpful for their exams. I kid you not, extremely helpful for their exams. So I will encourage you to check these courses out. I think you're going to find it to be extremely, extremely helpful. And then these courses are not lectures, right? They're pretty much almost all exclusively clinical scenarios, exam style problems. And then I use those to teach you the concepts and help you integrate the concepts across multiple disciplines. And also don't forget that I have a 100-hour step two, step three course coming up in the month of late April and most of May. That's more for step two, step three. And I'm going to have another new class coming up soon. So just shoot me an email through the website if you want some more information. Or you can just email me at divineinterventionpodcasts@gmail.com. Podcasts with an S at the end. divineinterventionpodcasts@gmail.com. Okay, so let's continue. So what if they give you, again, these classic signs and symptoms of spinal cord compression, but then they give you like a hook? What do I mean by a hook? A hook is like some extra information that tells you that this is what's going on, right? So you see a person, they have like signs and symptoms of spinal cord compression, and you notice that their temperature is 102 degrees Fahrenheit. Clearly, that's going to be an epidural abscess. That's going to be a spinal epidural abscess, right? Or they give you a question about a person that has these signs and symptoms of spinal cord compression, and they were recently like in a motor vehicle accident. Well, unfortunately, this is a traumatic cause of spinal cord compression, right? You probably had like some kind of vertebral fracture or something that's causing their issues. Or what if they give you a question about a patient, and they tell you that this patient, they've had a mastectomy in the past and they're having signs and symptoms of spinal cord compression. That's cancer that has come back, right? That's pretty much like metastatic cancer. Remember, many cancers love to metastasize to the spine, breast cancer, prostate cancer. I remember prostate cancer loves to use this Batson vertebral plexus. That's a high yield factor to know for your exams. The Batson vertebral plexus to, kind of seed to the spinal cord, right? If they give you, signs and symptoms of spinal cord compression, and you see it's more chronic, and you see it in a person that is really old, and this person has like chronic back pain, chronic leg pain, where you clearly want to think about spinal cord stenosis, right? Spinal stenosis. Or they give you a question about a person that, again, has signs and symptoms of spinal cord compression, and they tell you that, oh, this person was recently diagnosed with AFib and was placed on anticoagulation. They want to think about some kind of spinal epidural hematoma. And here's the thing. Whenever you suspect that a person has spinal cord compression, you always want to get an MRI. Simple as that. Always get what? An MRI. Always get what? An MRI. Always get an MRI. right? Always get an MRI. And in general, you know, many times they don't go after treatment of these, but there are some things you probably want to know about treatment, right? Like, for example, if a person has like spinal cord compression, and they have it because they have like cancer or whatever, right? You should clearly do two things for those people. Number one, so that's after you've gotten the MRI. Number one, you're going to give steroids. You're going to give IV steroids, high dose steroids, and they're going to send them for surgery, right? Let them get surgical decompression. Actually, a third step you can add is radiotherapy, okay? So get the MRI. You're going to see the cause of spinal cord compression. And then how do you manage it? Number one, IV steroids, high dose glucocorticoids. Number two, surgical decompression. Right. And then number three, the person is going to get radiotherapy. Right. And then, you know, if a person has a B12 problem or a copper problem, just supplement. Right. That's why people that have had like gastric bypass. Remember that bariatric surgery example I gave with copper deficiency? Those people tend to get like copper, a bunch of supplementation. So they don't develop all these problems. Right. And then obviously, if it's an infection or whatever, right, go ahead and treat the underlying infection, right? Transverse myelitis, IV steroids as well, right? Transverse myelitis, IV steroids as well. Now, please never use IV steroids to treat a spinal cord compression that's caused by like infection or hematoma. Don't use steroids for that. That's not a good idea. You're going to worsen those problems, right? And one of the like hyper-specialized bit, again, this podcast, I'm sorry, kind of sounds a little disorganized, but it's because these disorders are just kind of all over the place. But again, I promise you, this is a very, very high yield podcast to know for your exams, right? But if a person has like these liquid tumors, I don't know how else to put this, like liquid tumors that are causing spinal cord compression, right? So things like leukemia, right? All these blood cancers, leukemia, lymphoma, multiple myeloma and whatnot. These people, if they have spinal cord compression on your exams, I will encourage you, pick the answer that says radiotherapy. Pick the answer that says radiotherapy. That's a much better answer for these people on your exams. I kid you not, in terms of just treatment. So we're going to go ahead and stop here. Again, I offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE exams, step one to step three, complex one to three, preclinical med school exams, third-year shelf exams. Again, I have review courses for step one all the way to step three. The step one class is 25 hours long. Step two class is 20 hours long. And then I have a series of smaller classes that, again, people also find to be very helpful. And then I have these podcasts on Apple, Google, and Spotify. I have a YouTube channel. That's where I post the videos that I make. So you can check those out. And then also, I have another website called DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. Every week I post two podcasts from a biblical perspective. I try to address a life lesson. We have almost 250 podcasts on there. There's actually an Apple podcast associated with that called the Divine Intervention Life Lessons podcast. And then I also help with ERAS applications, you know, editing personal statements, brainstorming over personal statements and all those things, mock interviews. So if you're interested in any of these things, just shoot me an email and I'll be happy to give you some more direction. So thank you for listening to me today. Please listen to this podcast. I promise you, it is very high yield. So have a wonderful rest of your day. God bless you and bye for now. Thank you.